This is the Inland Journal. I'm Doug Nadvornik. Last week, we talked with Spokane City Council President Ben Stuckert about his proposed Spokane Fair Elections program. This week, the plan went to the City Council. On Monday evening, Stuckert said the proposal attempts to improve a local system in which more money is being spent in candidate races, yet fewer people are voting.
And let me emphasize that this is all within the bounds of state and federal law. I believe Citizens United has damaged this country beyond repair, but it is the law of the land, and thus we are limited in our ability to really tackle the biggest issue plaguing our local elections, independent expenditures.
Here are a few of the major points. In the proposal written by Stuckert and Councilman Brian Beggs, the maximum contribution limits would be halved from $1,000 to $500. They define when candidates can raise money. Council candidates running in 2019 are not allowed to accept donations until January 1, 2018. And certain entities, such as public sector unions and companies that contract with the city, may face bans or limitations on contributions. Companies with more than $50,000 in city contracts over a two-year period are forbidden from giving money to candidates.
Contractors are still allowed to participate in local elections through the independent expenditure process. City contractors have contributed close to $90,000 directly to city elected officials while receiving $116 million in city contracts. I've never seen quid pro quo corruption in any of these contracts, but the perception of corruption exists.
As for labor unions, Stuckert says for legal reasons, the city cannot prohibit union contributions, but it can make them transparent.
This ordinance requires that the amount of money spent by City of Spokane bargaining units in support or against current elected officials be disclosed right there on their bargaining unit contract for all of their members to see.
On Monday evening, public testimony was more con than pro. We'll replay a few of the highlights, starting with a little holiday poetic license by Spokane County Republican Party Chairwoman Stephanie Cates.
It was the week before Christmas, and all through Spokane, City Council overreaches just because they can. Visions of legislative balance no more will be dancing if this council messes with campaign financing. It means private contractors can't influence elections, but it gives public sector unions special protections. Incumbents enjoy a stacked deck, early fundraising in their favor, while challengers start behind without such a waiver. As the climate keeps changing, there's a chill in the air, because soon our elections will be anything but fair.
One of Kate's main arguments, and that of others who testified, is that the ordinance treats labor unions and private contractors differently. Just as Stuckert argues about the perception of corruption, Kate's argues there is a perception that this gives labor unions an unfair advantage.
If you truly want to ensure an even playing field, I would implore you to hold unions to the same standard as private contractors and keep the individual donation limit where it is now. I also think it's critical for council members Kinnear and Stratton to recuse themselves from this vote. The ordinance changes the rules for their challengers while allowing them to continue their early lead on fundraising.
One contractor weighed in. Grant Keller said he didn't like the implicit message within the proposal.
So I get pretty frustrated and angry hearing some sort of insinuation that I as a contractor or other contractors in this community are going to come write one of you a check to try and get a project like that going or win favor with the City of Spokane. That's a pretty unfortunate statement.
Arthur Witten from the Spokane Home Builders Association took up the equal treatment for unions and contractors argument. Instead of banning contractors from giving, require disclosure of donations in the same manner as unions. Witten says he also worries the ordinance will add another piece of city bureaucracy.
The citizens of Spokane have been told throughout the process and the drafting of this ordinance that, first, this ordinance would cost the city nothing, that it'd be a repurposing of city staff from the sunsetting sick and safe leave. Then the citizens were told, well, this will cost about $25,000 for the hiring of a clerk. And then it was also told, well, we're also shifting funds for education, business education and training and implementation. And I'm concerned, and our association's concerned, that there hasn't been an accurate estimation of what this will cost the taxpayers.
And finally, Councilman Mike Fagan credited Stuckert and Beggs for their hard work in researching and crafting their proposal. But he said this issue should be legislated at the state level so that everyone in Washington is following the same rules.
I personally would feel as though my First Amendment speech rights are being restricted just by the simple fact that you know, we are going to be calling for campaign contribution limits that are going to be 50% of what the state allows at this point. So, again, I appreciate the work. I acknowledge, I recognize the work. It's a Herculean effort, and I wish that I could share the same feelings that you have in the success that you anticipate.
Two speakers supported the ordinance. One is Pam Baring, the president of the Spokane chapter of the League of Women Voters. She believes the changes are needed to reverse an erosion of trust in the election process.
It's a step toward restoring that confidence. We have to believe that we are heard, that our $5, $10, $50 contribution is important, and therefore, as League, we encourage you to support this.
Before casting his vote, Councilman Brian Beggs acknowledged the ordinance is not a perfect solution to an imperfect campaign system. Some of what people want isn't legally allowed.
The current Supreme Court, by a narrow one-vote majority, has ruled out several things. Some people said they wish overall expenditures could be limited. That can't be done. Some people wish different restrictions on organizations and entities. That can't be done. We originally, those of us who were talking about this ordinance, we wanted to put a restriction on the few public unions that we deal with at the city on contributions if there are open contracts. That was in the first draft. We wanted to do that.
But city attorneys warned against it. The council approved the measure by a 6-1 vote, Councilman Fagan against. Sometime in the next 5 business days, the proposal will be sent to the mayor. He has 10 days to sign all of it, part of it, or veto it. If he doesn't sign it in that period and yet doesn't veto it, it will become law. If he vetoes it, the council will have 30 days to determine how to proceed. It needs 5 votes to override a veto. And now a short civics lesson about school funding in Washington and what's next. The light is at the end of the tunnel for Washington legislators as far as public school funding goes and satisfying a mandate from the state Supreme Court to spend more money for schools. State Superintendent Chris Rakedahl says the court has signed off on the legislature's remedy that includes raising the state property tax next year.
I think the court said to the legislature, you got it done from the perspective of the court. You used the formulas that we said were basic education that the legislature wrote in 2009 and 2010. You did make sure that the state money is now going to cover those formulas instead of locally funded property taxes. But you're taking too long. The court was really clear to say, we had an expectation this would be done in 2018. Your full plan doesn't really kick in until 2019. So we need you to speed that up as much as you can. The court didn't ask for another $1 billion of new money. They said you really got to pull something forward here to satisfy our timeline.
So they're still going to have to come up with $1 billion extra. They're just sooner rather than later.
Yeah, and I think that's the big hard question. Because they closed this last little increment with state property tax, you really can't go faster on that. You can't impose that any quicker. There are mechanics to the local auditors and local assessors, you know, getting the mechanics of that in place. So there's discussion on whether or not the legislature will use some one-time fund balance. The revenue forecast growth continues to improve, so can they essentially assume a good economic fortunes going forward and spend some money sooner. So there's lots of people thinking about how to do this faster.
So that's where Washington legislators will start in January. And now we go back to the original question we had for Rakedahl. Where does all the money Washington spends for schools come from?
It comes from the state general fund. And so it is primarily sales tax, B&O tax, and property tax as the three big sources. But there isn't really a particular source specifically funding schools. What they solved, if you will, this last session, the last increment of what they needed is coming from a state property tax. But again, that's just an increment. We're spending roughly $13 billion a year on schools. And again, the vast bulk of that sales tax, B&O tax, and some state property.
Local money that that people will pay. Has that percentage gone up in recent memory?
Yeah, that's a more complicated question, but yes, depending on where you are regionally, it used to hover at 24, sometimes in excess of 28% of local school budgets was coming from those local school levies. And that's when the court eventually stepped in and said, you know, you're paying for basics out of locally voted levies that may or may not pass. Therefore, we're really not guaranteeing each student a basic education.
So what about special education? How's that paid for?
It is supposed to be a basic education provision, so it's supposed to come from the state. It's a little different in that, unlike a general education student, a special education student is entitled to the basic ed amount plus an additional 93% of the basic education amount on average, and that's what's important. It's not an entitlement to an individual student, but in all of the students who are qualifying for special education in the Spokane School District, for example, each of those student FTEs, each of those full-time equivalent students, would be getting an additional 93% on top of basic education. Again, should be provided by the state.
With the legislature kicking in extra money, with the Supreme Court weighing in on it, are you satisfied that finally basic education is getting the amount of funding that it deserves in Washington?
Couple thoughts on that. I think the really basic formulas are getting addressed now by the state. It's a really positive thing. It was bipartisan. It was hard work. I give them all the credit in the world for just an enormous leap over the next 4 years and how much they're going to spend to make sure the state covers it. I continue to believe that those formulas, while they are the current definition of basic education, were drafted quite a while ago, and some of them, in my opinion, are not current. So even if you believe enough money is now provided for special education based on the old formulas, I would suggest to you that that is not the future of special education. These students are going to need a lot more intensive support. And so did they solve the current definition of basic? Yes, I think they did. Is it the one we would want if we were designing the system tomorrow? Absolutely not. In the same way that in the 1960s, the court would have said, oh, you got to fund everybody through an eighth grade education. That was basic education at the time. And we now know that's laughable. I mean, you can imagine what would happen if we only educated our kids through the eighth grade. So basic education evolves through time. And I think the legislature did a good job kind of resnapping the line based on where they are today. But we're trying to push on and have a much bigger conversation about what that system should look like tomorrow, including enhancements for special ed, enhancements for career and technical education that go beyond what they just did.
Given that the legislature spent so much time talking about education over the last 4 years, do you think there's much appetite for getting into something like that?
It's a really fair question. I do think there's some fatigue, and it's not a matter of legislators not caring deeply about public education. I think some of them on both sides of the aisle would say, there are also other things we want to pay attention to and put energy into, and I feel like in some ways they believe some of that's kind of been in the shadows. It's understandable, but again, your paramount duty is basic ed in this state. What we're trying to say to them is, well, let's have a very different conversation about what we get from education in the future. So it's not a routine conversation about formulas. But what outcomes do you want? Are you satisfied with 80% graduation rates? Because we think we should be number one in the country. So we think we got to push up into the mid to high 90s to be realistic for our economy. And as I've been pretty public about, I think that means big transformation for our schools. Going to essentially a year-round school model, adding additional instructional hours, thinking very differently about the 11th and 12th grades so that kids can graduate ready for industry. We're excited to have a bigger conversation, so there might be some McCleary fatigue, but I'm confident there isn't a fatigue about what high-quality public schools look like.
Well, it sounds to me like those types of conversations need to be had with the public before you can get to the legislature. What are you hearing from the schools who report to you?
Well, they're in this really, difficult time where they're trying to understand all the changes that just came their way. So they are really receptive to transformation. They see a bigger vision. They know they've got to improve on graduates. They know they've got to do better work on students in poverty and second language learners and communities of color. So they see the gaps. I think what they would say is, we definitely want to think about that. We want to begin to plan for that, but we really got to understand what just happened to us. We just got our local levies reduced. The state's going to backfill all or most of it. Some districts ended up better than others. So there's a little bit of reeling right now. They're thinking, wow, that's a lot of change you're pushing forward when we don't fully understand what just happened. We have the mental capacity to do both right now.
So I want to be clear, does this mean that local school levies go away, or are they smaller, or are they, what's the future for those?
Smaller. Certainly in the short run, they're smaller. They can no longer be used to fund basic ed, but they can still be used for enrichment. So I always think of sort of the classic school district who has a regular 180-day school year, 1,000 instructional hours, but then they say, you know what, we've got kids in programs, they want to go longer into the summer, or some kids need additional support, or we have activities that aren't basic ed, but we really want to invest in them. Maybe it's science clubs or robotics or something. That's still going to come from locally voted on enrichment levies. And those have limits. The legislature just put some new limits on them. I actually think it's a little silly to restrict them so aggressively if they no longer are covering basic ed and it's completely enrichment and it's a vote of the people that puts them in place. I'm advocating that we get a little more flexibility for our districts on these local levies.
So how do you think rural school districts as a whole are going to be affected by this? Do you think it's going to allow them to add things that they're not able to afford right now?
You know, it's really a mixed bag, and here's why. The legislature changed the way we compensate our teachers in this new finance system. So there are rural districts who do quite a bit better because they were not able to raise a lot of local levy money. They don't have the tax base. It would have just been absolutely prohibitive to have such a high tax rate in order to fund teachers at the rate that other districts pay. So some of them get additional help from the state now to pay a more competitive salary for their teachers. So their funding system got a little better. There are other rural districts, though, who were very veteran staffs. In other words, they had very experienced teachers and administrators and classified employees. And now that the state only gives everybody an average amount per employee, instead of actually funding the real cost of who they hire, you will see some rural districts who say, oh, man, it's nice that the state stepped up, but I lost some local levy authority, and the state no longer pays me for my really experienced staffers. And so even in parts of rural Washington, some of them are saying, this system didn't work out quite as well as I hoped it would. So it's kind of a mixed bag in rural Washington.
Okay, Chris, I think that's good for me. Was there anything that I didn't ask you about that you wanted to talk about or bring up?
Well, I think the other question that's pretty consistent we hear is, what about capital budget? If the legislature is investing more in students and they're lowering class sizes and we're expecting more career and technical education, do we have the facilities to even do that? And it's a really good question because the court affirmed that is not necessarily basic education. It's not an obligation of the state. And yet you think, oh my gosh, if the state doesn't pay for that and I'm in a rural community, how in the world can I raise enough resources to build a whole new building or even a classroom sometimes? So we have matching funds here in my office, and the legislature is poised to increase them if they can pass a capital budget. And we're going to push really hard over the next couple years to increase that very specifically so that communities with low tax bases, very rural agricultural communities, can still have a shot at high quality facilities, particularly that we've evolved in science and math and engineering. They need really good space there too, and it's been tough for them. So the capital space is the other parallel conversation to all the changes in the operating budgets.
Chris Rakedahl is Washington State School Superintendent. School funding is not just a timely issue in Washington. In the next few weeks, we'll learn more about a proposed change for school funding in Idaho. One of Spokane's largest ethnic communities comes from the Marshall Islands in the Pacific Ocean. The islands are located near the equator between Hawaii and the Philippines. For thousands of years, the Marshallese people have had their own culture and traditions. But because of the island's perceived strategic importance, the Japanese military occupied them during World War II. When the Japanese surrendered, the U.S. took possession and immediately found a use for them. Atomic bombs were detonated 67 times between 1946 and 1958 in the atmosphere above and the water between the Marshall Islands. Newsreels tell the stories about how American doctors studied the Marshallese people for signs of radiation-related illnesses.
229 natives and 28 American service personnel received doses ranging from 12 to 200 rentgens.
Since then, the islands have remained important to the U.S., even after becoming independent in 1986. Because of that, residents there are free to travel to the U.S., and tens of thousands live here now. University of Washington anthropologist Holly Barker studies the Marshall Islands. She lived and worked there for 15 years.
For the people of the Marshall Islands, there are a lot of violences that continue from the testing program, the inability to live on their home islands, the health care issues and problems that remain with them today, the residual radiation on the islands. And so there's a great need for awareness and understanding and friendship and solidarity. What are our responsibilities as U.S. citizens, as people of Washington State, to think about the role that Hanford played and the connections to this community?
About 1,000 Marshallese now make their homes in Spokane. Ryan Douse is a liaison to that community for the Spokane School District.
The Marshallese are always very welcoming people. You always get food when you go to events. You can, if you go around to local parks, you can see them out there. They run a lot of softball tournaments, volleyball. Just a very family, community-driven culture.
Douse is also a master's degree student in public health at Eastern Washington University. He works to connect Marshallese people with health care. Right now, that's a challenge. For in 1996, federal welfare reforms removed people from the Marshall Islands for eligibility in the Medicaid program. So low-income Marshallese people have limited options for care. Douse says that means their first stop when they get sick is often a hospital emergency room.
What we're trying to do is resolve that issue and get them some health insurance so that they could start seeking other access, you know, monthly appointments or yearly appointments. Because with that access issue, there's a high rate of diabetes and cancer, different cancers within the community because of the atomic testing that occurred.
A Marshallese man sings to welcome people to a public forum last Saturday at a central Spokane church. The purpose was to tell the stories of the Marshallese people here in Spokane and talk about their health challenges. A Marshallese elder stands at the front of the church to tell his story. A younger man translates for him.
We would like to help members of our community, of the Marshallese community, and not being able to access Medicare or the other health insurance is something that we would like to overcome.
Joining them on stage was Spokane Democratic State Representative Marcus Richelli. He's the co-sponsor of a bill in the legislature that would allow the Marshallese and other low-income Pacific Islanders in Washington to get financial help to buy their health insurance. Later in an interview, he told us about it.
Right now in Washington State, through the Affordable Care Act and through the Obamacare expansion of Medicaid, everybody who's a citizen under 133% of the federal poverty level receives Apple Health, which is free. This would just be for those same folks in that 133% or less of the federal poverty level would just be premium assistance to help them purchase their premiums on health care.
But it wouldn't be free to them.
They'd would not be free.
Richelli was followed on stage by a woman who called herself the crowd's Pacific Islander sister. Tai Tufono is a member of Washington's Commission on Asian Pacific American Affairs. She's a native of Micronesia, of which the Marshall Islands is also a part.
We got to be strong, brothers and sisters. We got to be strong. We got to make sure that these bills pass. We got to make sure that our people are taken care of. It's your right.
The bill, co-sponsored by Marcus Richelli, passed the House on a party-line vote earlier this year, but it didn't receive a vote in the Senate. He hopes with Democrats regaining control of the Senate next month that the bill will be approved. He says Governor Inslee has included money for that, about $2 million, in his budget for next year. If the bill passes, it means hundreds of Spokane residents, including this group singing the anthem of the Marshall Islands, might be able to bypass the emergency rooms and see their doctors to get the care they need. By the way, you can hear our full interview with UW anthropologist Holly Barker on the Inland Journal page of the Spokane Public Radio website. She talks about the Marshall Islands and about two of its unique ties to American pop culture. You can also hear Inland Journal podcasts and archives on that page. Next week on the program, we'll talk with retiring All Things Considered host Robert Siegel. He's leaving the program next month. And if you have a question you'd love for me to ask him for you, send it to me at inlandjournal at kpbx.org. Thank you for your support of Spokane Public Radio and Inland Journal. We're pleased to air stories on issues you won't hear or read about on other local media. Merry Christmas. I'm Doug Nadvornik.